It's 7 minutes past 1 o'clock. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Novelist Dara Horn was to be our guest this afternoon. We've had to reschedule that interview. She's now on the schedule for Monday, March 13th. Dara Horn's latest novel is The World to Come. She'll be talking about her book in the Chicago area later this week. She'll do a reading at the bookstall at Chestnut Court in Winnetka on Wednesday evening, February 22nd. That event is set for 7 p.m., so if you're in the Chicagoland area and you'd like to meet and hear Dara Horn, well, get out to the bookstall in Winnetka, 7 p.m. Wednesday, February 22nd. Coming up this afternoon in this portion of the program, an interview from the archives, the interview conducted on January 25th of this year. Because it's a recorded interview, we won't be taking phone calls this afternoon, but we do hope you will enjoy the upcoming interview. Stay tuned. This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. On the program today, we're going to take a look at the world, the life, and the music of Sam Cooke. Our guest is biographer and music historian Peter Guralnick, the author of Dream Boogie, The Triumph of Sam Cooke. Sam Cooke loved the spotlight from the time he was a small boy. He was also a very smart child. His younger brother, Elsie, tells a story about Sam that Peter Guralnick uses to open the first chapter of Dream Boogie. Sam was 9, Elsie was 7, and Sam told Elsie he'd figured out the whole system. "It's designed," Sam said, "if you work, to keep you working, all you do is live from payday to payday, and at the end of the week, you're broke again." Sam told his brother he would never have a 9-to-5 job. Sam said, "I'm going to sing, and I'm going to make me a lot of money." And as Elsie observes, and that's just what he did. Sam Cooke started in gospel, then crossed over into pop. We're most familiar with Cooke's pop hits, including You Send Me, Chain Gang, and A Change Is Gonna Come. But let's listen here to one of the gospel tunes he composed and recorded with the Soul Stirrers. This is Touch the Hem of His Garment. It was recorded in 1956.
Whoa, there was a woman in the Bible days. She had been sick, sick so very long. But she heard my Jesus was passing by, so she joined the gathering throng. And while she was pushing her way through, someone asked her, "What are you trying to do?" She said, "If I could just touch the hem of his garment, I know I made whole. She cried, "Oh, and oh, and oh, and oh, said if I could just touch the hem of his garment, I know I'll be made whole." And oh, she spent her money here and there until she had no more to spare.
Touch the Hem of His Garment, composed by Sam Cooke, recorded with the Soul Stirrers in 1956. Peter Guralnick is the author of 8 books, including the 2-part Elvis Presley biography, Last Train to Memphis, and Careless Love. His other books include Searching for Robert Johnson and the novel Nighthawk Blues. Peter Guralnick, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
I'm glad to be here.
Would you tell us first about the poem that gives this biography its title?
Well, it's the great Langston Hughes poem, Dream Boogie, and I think it brings together the cultural underpinning for the civil rights movement, the way in which the nexus between the two and the way in which the two really were inseparable, not just in Sam Cooke's life, but in the life and music both of civil rights leaders and the musicians, everyone from Mahalia Jackson to Duke Ellington. And it speaks of, ain't you heard the boogie-woogie rumble of a dream deferred, and the sense of that. Langston Hughes wrote again and again, this is back as early as 1951, about this sense of a dream deferred, which became such an underpinning of the idea for the civil rights movement. But this, in a sense, was a prescient of the language of that movement and the idea that what should serve as its undercurrent was that boogie-woogie rumble, and that's the music coming. It's the proclamation of African-American culture. It's the sense that Zora Neale Hurston proclaimed that, hey, we don't have anything to be ashamed of. We should be proud of our culture. And that was something that I think was coming. It was represented in Langston Hughes's work. It was represented in James Baldwin's work. And it was represented in Sam Cooke's work.
Yeah, and that work and the music of Sam Cooke, the work of Sam Cooke, and his life, in essence, a dream boogie. Is all of this together why you wanted to write this book?
Yes, I mean, it is. I mean, and it for me, it was a very broad-based theme and a very broad-based subject, and one that I began or that I first caught sight of when I was working on Sweet Soul Music, Rhythm and Blues and the Southern Dream of Freedom, which I began in 1980. And the way in which, I mean, this was a world in which I was caught up musically from the time I was a kid. But when I started working on this book and in some ways seeking a Sweet Soul Music and seeking, what you call reification of something that I had only dreamt of myself, it just hit home harder and harder how the movement was accompanied almost in lockstep with the music and with the culture. You just couldn't separate the two. You couldn't say one led the other, but neither could you say that one was ahead of the other. And when I met Sam Cooke's friend, mentor, and business partner, J.W. Alexander, in 1982 to interview him about Sam Cooke, whom I saw as the linchpin, he and Ray Charles, for this Southern rhythm, gospel-based rhythm and blues that I was writing about. When I met J.W., he painted a picture of Sam that was so extraordinary and so wide-ranging and so much beyond simply someone who was gifted with a heavenly voice, that from that point on, from 82 on, I knew I wanted to write a biography of Sam Cooke, but one that embodied a much wider concerns than simply setting down the facts of one individual's life.
Yeah. I played Touch the Hem of His Garment during the introduction, and that comes from the CD Portrait of a Legend, and you wrote the liner notes for that recording, for this disc. And you say of this tune, Touch the Hem of His Garment, this is Sam telling a Bible story, as he had learned to do from his preacher father, and as he would do all his life. Tell us about Sam Cooke as a storyteller.
As a storyteller, I mean, from the very beginning, from the time he started singing with his family group, the Singing Children, which I think was four or five of his brothers and sisters, which he started in when he was about 7 years old. But from that point on to when he joined the Highway QCs and then the Soul Stirrers at 19, the Highway QCs were a teenage gospel group who never recorded while Sam was with them. And then he went to the number one gospel group in the country when he was 19 years old, taking over as lead singer from probably the most celebrated lead singer of that day, R.H. Harris. But in all of these groups, and particularly with the Highway QCs and the Soul Stirrers, he essentially reorganized familiar material. It could be spirituals that were standard part of the repertoire of any number of groups. It could simply be Bible tales. But he reorganized them and, in that sense, rewrote them to tell them with a clarity and with a sense of opening up the story and portraying characters within the stories in a very limited way. I mean, he only had 2.5 minutes to tell the story, but it was important to him to give his listener his listeners characters that they could fix their attention on and a story that they could follow clearly all the way through. This was exactly, I mean, you can hear it in Touch the Hem of His Garment, which, according to Bumps Blackwell, the producer of the session, who had just finished recording Little Richard's first sessions in New Orleans, and who, through the talent that he saw in Sam, saw someone who could be an even bigger pop star than Little Richard if Sam would cross over. But the way that Sam, the way that Bumps Blackwell tells the story, they were on the car on the way to the session. They were short of songs. The Soul Stirrers manager, S.R. Crane, said, "Sam, our, you know, our audience expects new songs." And Sam says, "Well, open the Bible anywhere." This is the part that may be apocryphal, but
it's a good story, though.
It's a great story. But Bumps watched in absolute awe as Sam put together a song. He struck a note. The other Soul Stirrers fell in, and he essentially told this familiar tale in idiomatic and colloquial terms. And if you think about Sam's songs all the way through, from Twisting the Night Away or Everybody Loves to Cha-Cha-Cha, right through to A Change is Going to Come, they all revolve around introducing this, you know, a colloquial expression, something that can people can grasp onto. I mean, for example, with A Change is Going to Come, I don't mean to jump ahead, but you have a song which is so familiar, and so familiar for its sentiment. You know, it was adopted almost from the time it came out as a kind of symbol of the civil rights movement. But the song itself, for all of its exalted sentiments, probably wouldn't have captured the attention of the public if it didn't have something like "It's Been a Long Time Coming," which could be applied to almost anything. "But I know a change is going to come." It's Sam hitting on that note, which is both familiar and yet open-ended enough so it can apply to any number of situations, that allows his songs to live.
Yeah. Well, maybe we should listen to that song.
I don't want to rush you. I was just...
No, that's okay. Let's go with the flow.
Sure.
A Change is Going to Come. You call this his magnum opus.
Right.
Anything else you want to say before we hear it?
Well, I think that, again, it shows the extent to which Sam Cooke's imagination and his what really amounted to an analytic state of mind. I mean, Sam Cooke was very much of an intellectual, but to the extent to which this can be subsumed to his creative genius, and because the song lives as a living, breathing, interpretable instrument, something which can be just as applicable to the recent hurricane in New Orleans as it was for the civil rights movement. I mean, it can be just as much of an anthem because of the way it's written. But the three, the three impetuses for the song were the civil rights movement in general and the March on Washington in August of '63, Bob Dylan's "Blowing in the Wind," which Sam heard in that summer of '63 on the album for the Freewheeling Bob Dylan, and he said to J.W. Alexander, his friend J.W., he said, "You know, it makes me almost ashamed that a white boy should have written a song like this. It makes me ashamed not to have written something like this myself." And then the third thing which really provided the impetus was his own arrest in Shreveport in October of '63 for refusing to be turned away from a segregated motel. But it's a song which, while it's suggested by his own personal experience to some extent, really suggests a much broader experience, the experience of a generation, the experience of a people, but also the whole sense of what it comes back to that Langston Hughes thing, you know, what becomes of a dream deferred.
Okay, here's A Change is Going to Come.
In a little tent, oh, and just like the river, I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will.
It's been too hard living, but I'm afraid to die. 'Cause I don't know what's up there beyond the sky. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Somebody keep telling me don't hang around. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. Then I go to my brother. I say, brother, help me, please. But he winds up knocking me back down on my knees. Oh, there have been times that I thought I couldn't last for long. But I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will.
A change is gonna come, recorded in 1964 in Hollywood,
right.
California. Boy, that is so powerful.
Well, it is, and you can see, I think, I mean, not to belabor the point, but you, the mix of elements that go into it, you have him, I was born in a little, by the river, I was in a little tent. Well, obviously, Sam wasn't born in a little tent, but it suggests baptism. It broadens the experience. But then you have something like, I go to the movies and I go downtown, but somebody keep telling me don't hang around, is something that could just as clearly be suggested by his own experience.
Yeah.
And so it mixes these two. These two elements of the general and the particular. I go to my brother and I ask him, please, and it's, you know, this is going to the white establishment, but he just keeps on knocking me right down to my knees. So you have this mix, and it's something with which generation after generation has been able to identify and to apply to. I mean, obviously the words may have to be changed to some degree, but it was a song that was sung over and over in the wake of Katrina, for example, and I think not accidentally, not coincidentally. It's not a soppy song.
Yeah. You know, picking up your book was such a great reason to go back to the music and listen through to these songs once again. And one of the things that I was struck by is the range. You can have something that's so much fun, you know, the cha-cha-cha.
Right.
And then you can have this, or you can have Nothing Can Change This Love. And the gospel tunes are so wonderful as well.
Well, you know, I wish that, I don't think you were there, and I wish that all your listeners could have been in Cleveland, where the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame held a week-long celebration of Sam Cooke's life and music, which ended up in two concerts last November. The first was a pop concert, the second was a gospel. And it was all of the music was by Sam Cooke, and it had everybody from Aretha Franklin to Solomon Burke to William Bell to Otis Clay to the Dixie Hummingbirds to the Five Blind Boys to Taj Mahal to the Manhattans, who did a phenomenal job, to Elvis Costello and Peter Wolfe, it was just and each of these singers and all these really great these artists, individual in their own rights, took the songs of Sam Cooke. I mean, nothing but the songs of Sam Cooke, gospel and pop, and managed to create these two concerts, which diverse in mood and in coloration, and entertaining and deep. And what was extraordinary about it was not only did the audience take this experience from it. I mean, I'm speaking not to promote anything. It just was because nobody will ever see it. It just happened. But, I mean, it created such an extraordinary, I hate to use the word spiritual, but it was really a spiritual atmosphere, communication not just with the audience but among the performers. It was really remarkable, and I can think of few, singer-songwriters who could sustain that kind of, kind of tribute for two full nights, with their work.
Yeah, another example of the triumph of Sam
Cooke.
Right. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Peter Guralnick is our guest this afternoon here on the program. His latest book is Dream Boogie, The Triumph of Sam Cooke. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. The phone numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Let's go back to his family life and his growing up in Chicago. His dad was a preacher and so a storyteller. And it seems Sam's father was a very good preacher. He filled his church. And to get a seat, you had to show up on time. What would you like to tell us about the Reverend Charles Cooke?
Well, his children all portray him as a very stern man, but a very fair man. He was also somebody who, when he was preaching, would stand on one foot for, and I'm unclear as to exactly, but let's say a minute and a half, which everybody took as an extraordinary amount of time to, to sustain a one-footed sermon. And his favorite song, which he sang at almost every church service, was This Little Light of Mine, which eventually Sam would record at the Copa. Without anyone knowing that this had been his father's favorite song. But his father had a sense, a strong sense of morality, but also a strong sense of pride, I mean, even to the point of entitlement. And the thing that he taught his children over and over again was not only don't ever let anyone set any limits on you, don't ever set any limits on yourself. Whatever you do, be the best at it. You're going to be a street sweeper, be the best street sweeper there is. He also had a strong entrepreneurial spirit and felt that, that you shouldn't take a back seat to anyone, to any man or woman, that there was no reason to take crumbs off of the white man's table or anybody else's table. You may do for yourself. And I think these were all lessons which, in one way or another, sustained Sam all through his life.
Yeah. And it, going back to the introduction when I related the story of Sam and his brother, and Sam figuring out the system.
Right.
These lessons sunk in, and he learned them early.
Yeah, no, I mean, he had an extraordinary intellect. I mean, it's for instance, in writing about Elvis Presley was an extremely bright person, an intuitively bright person who saw to the heart of things and the heart of people in a way that was very unusual. He did not possess an analytic cast of mind. Sam, from the earliest age, really tried to figure everything out, and he pursued things in a very systematic way, while at the same time maintaining, an artistic awareness and artistic temperament that always, I mean, he was driven to create. Had he not written songs, had he not been gifted with a voice that he had, he might well have written novels, he might have painted paintings, but his creative urge would have found some means of expression. But it's interesting, when you have somebody like Sam's brother, L.C., talking about how Sam said he had figured out the system, in many situations like this, when you do an interview, you think, well, this is somebody just putting words on, anachronistically back, that they figured out years later. The reason that I don't think that's true, and it held true in almost all the interviews I did, when people spoke about Sam, whether it was L.C. or J.W. Alexander or Bobby Womack or Sam's widow, Barbara, whatever their individual differences were, whatever their differences in perspective, and they were vast in some cases, or their, when they cited Sam, the words that came out all came out in the same voice. And L.C. Cook, for example, who's a very bright, very intuitive, and very charming person, he simply doesn't think in terms like the system. This just is not something that would occur to him at the age of 70, you know, two, any more than it would have occurred to him at the age of seven. So when he says that Sam said this to him, I believe that Sam said it to him, because it, he's not speaking in his own language.
Mm. How did these folks talk about Sam Cooke's flaws? And something that you mention early in the book, I don't know whether it's in the author's note. You know, people say to you, how do you feel about the flaws? Do they bother you? Answer both those questions, if you would.
Well, I mean, I you know, I said in the introduction that I stand with Lithophane Pridgen, a friend of Sam's and later a friend of Jimi Hendrix's, who says, you know, he said, I'm not looking for any white picket fence. I'm not looking for any picture postcard view. I believe the reality is far more interesting and far more worthy of our attention. And then when we try to reduce reality to a kind of Disneyfied version, we're stuck with a we're stuck with a lie which really yields very little in the way of insight or truth. But in terms of I feel as if, you know, it's exactly the same as what one does, what we all do in our lives. I mean, none of us has been born of perfect parents. None of us has led perfect lives. And the friends that we have, we see them doing things of which we may disapprove. We see them doing things that we wish that they wouldn't, that it might be better for them if they didn't do. We see ourselves doing things that we may not be proud of. It doesn't cause us to, if we were to either limit our friendships to those people who are perfect or those people who only conform to our vision of the way things should be, it would be a very dull and dreary world, and a world that actually it would be a world in which we had no friends. So in that sense, I don't have a problem with, I want to deal with reality, I want to embrace reality, and that doesn't mean either condemning or condoning, it simply means describing. But in the case of Sam Cooke, I think what came up over and over again was that that sense that his father conveyed to him, to all of his children, never let yourself be disrespected, most of all, never let yourself be played, was something which, more than in the case of some of his other brothers and sisters, he allowed to carry him into reckless behavior, into a behavior in which it was almost as if he couldn't be harmed because he was right. And, for example, when a policeman in Memphis insulted or patronized him early on in 1959, 1960, told him to push his car, which had broken down, and he said, well, you push the car. And, you know, the policeman persisted, and he said, you know, I'm a singer. You wouldn't make Frank Sinatra push no car. And finally he said to the policeman, he said, well, you know, you may not know who I am, but your wife does. Mm-hmm. Go ask your wife about me. That's a very reckless thing to say in Memphis in 1959 or 1960. It might be a reckless thing to say today. And it's the same sort of thing where when he was playing at the Apollo for the first time, I think, in 59, and he went over to the Palm Cafe where there were, people would go to eat, and there was a broadcast, a Fat Jack Walker, I think, broadcast from there. And a guy comes up to him, a drunk comes up to him and says, you're not Sam Cooke. I know you're not Sam Cooke. If you're Sam Cooke, sing me a song. And he had the guy down on the floor, and he says, don't you ever talk to me like that. The guy may have used a few ruder terms. Mm-hmm. But the point is, again, it was that sense of almost overweening pride. And while I don't know a single person that I talked to who took such exception to that kind of pride as to reject Sam, there were certainly many people who recognized it as part of the makeup of his personality, and probably where it came out worst was in his relationship, if not with women, certainly with his wife Barbara, where Barbara, who had never spoken to anybody I'd never done an interview before. I spoke to her for this book, and it took about 6 years to finally speak to her. When she did, when we did finally get together, she said, "All right, what you want to know?" And then she started, and she gave really just the most brutally honest portrait of someone who so desperately wanted to be part of Sam's life. He was someone that she fell in love with when she was barely 13 years old, and he was 17. They had a child when she was just 17 herself, but they didn't get married for another, I'm trying to think how, for another 6 years. And it was a tempestuous relationship in so many ways. And there, I think, you can see the way in which the temperament that Sam had, which was so warm and so sunny and so open to the world in his public manner, like so many entertainers, in private closed up and didn't allow admittance and was that of someone who was much more of a solitary person. Now, this is not that unusual a thing for a, I think, for a creative artist, for someone who meets the public all the time, and I think you can find many, many instances of it, but it doesn't make it any less cruel or any less difficult to deal with.
Yeah. It seems he does reveal this part of himself in the music, though, in some of the music.
I think so. I think there's an undercurrent in so much of the music. I think even in a song like Nothing Can Change This Love, for example, which is all about, you're the apple of my eye, your cherry pie, your cake and ice cream, and it appears to be just this idealized version of love. The undercurrent of it is that nothing is ever like this, and there's this kind of sense of melancholy and of regret that runs through so many of his songs. I mean, it's having a party, for example, or That's Where It's At. Songs like that suggest that we had better seize the moment because the moment is all we have, and there's, again, this sense of that runs through it that's emphasized both by the music, by the way, and by the way in which Sam delivers the lyrics, that is altogether different from, let's say, the mood that you'll take from a Louis Jordan song. When Louis Jordan says "Let the good times roll," he means "Let the good times roll." When Sam says, "Let the good times roll," it's because we have this opportunity right now, and it may never come our way again.
Hmm. What do you say we take a listen to "Nothing Can Change This Love"?
Sure.
Okay.
If I go a million miles away, I'd write a letter each and every day, 'cause honey, nothing can ever change this love I have for you. Coming, and you can pass me by, but honey, nothing can ever change this love I have for you. Oh, you're the apple of my eye, your cherry pie. Your cake and ice cream, and all your sugar and spice, and everything nice. You're the girl of my dreams. But if you wanted to leave me and roam, when you got back, I'd just say, well, 'cause honey, nothing can ever change this love I have for you.
nothing can ever change the love I have for you.
Nothing Can Change This Love, Sam Cooke, a Sam Cooke composition recorded in 1962. Peter, you know, listening back to this music, I love it. The arrangements, though, they sound a little old-fashioned, but yet they sound so appropriate.
Well, you know, I mean, it's funny because for years people blamed others for the arrangements. But in fact, Sam Cooke dictated every note of every arrangement after a certain point, at least from 61 on. And, you know, I think that the strings stemmed from two. I mean, he literally sang the parts. He made two tapes for his arranger, Rene Hall, who was a very experienced, much older musician who went back to, his first experience was playing the calliope on the riverboats out of New Orleans, but who played every instrument and had done arrangements for everybody. And Rene Hall said working with Sam was an absolutely unique experience. He met Sam when Sam first crossed over in 1957 on the You Send Me session. And from that point on, he said it was an absolutely unique experience because Sam would come in with one tape on which he sang the melody to a guitar accompaniment, which might be him or it might be his guitarist, Cliff White. Then he brought in a second tape in which he sang over, he overdubbed on top of that melody the parts which each instrument would play, whether it was the French horn or it was the strings or it was the bass. And he insisted that Rene bring those tapes to the session so that Rene couldn't put anything over on him and say, well, but Sam, you didn't tell me to do it this way. but in terms of voicings, I think the voicings became more sophisticated as he grew older, although sometimes he just used rhythm sections. But I think if you listen to them, both the French horn and the viola were two instruments whose sound meant a great deal to Sam in terms of conveying that kind of mournfulness is the best word I can come up with. And I know in talking to Alan Toussaint, he told me, and I can only accede to his insight and musical knowledge, but he told me that it was the sixth chord which Sam fell back on from the very beginning, from his gospel songs on, that always lent even the most upbeat songs a kind of a melancholy tone.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that strikes me in listening to his later work and the earlier work, you know, takes you back to the gospel years, the voicings, the arrangements. He learned a lot from that experience, you know, when things come in and when, you know, when the second vocalist comes in and that kind of thing.
No, he learned a tremendous amount.
Yeah.
And in fact, he brought it back more and more in the last couple of years of his life, starting with Bring It On Home to Me, where Lou Rawls was the second voice, the answering voice, in a completely gospel-oriented fashion. And at that point, this was in the spring of 62, and at that point he made the determination, I think, having reached out to a broader audience, you know, wanting to, find a more, white audience as well as a black, but just an across-the-board kind of an audience. He made the determination to go back more and more, at least some of the time, to that gospel sound. And so songs like Ain't That Good News or Ease My Troubling Mind were straight out of the gospel repertoire. But in terms of setting them up, I mean, that's what's so unusual about when Sam made his debut in popular music in 1957, he had been a gospel star, the gospel star, the matinee idol of gospel music for 6 years. So he came in with a wealth of experience. And while it took him a certain amount of time to learn how best to adapt it in this new field, he came in. It wasn't as if he was coming up from the minor leagues.
Mm. Peter Guralnick, our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine, his latest book, Dream Boogie, The Triumph of Sam Cooke. This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. A listener is waiting to talk with us on line one in Champaign. Good afternoon.
Yes, good afternoon, Mr. Guralnick. I'm interested. I've been in and out of this conversation doing errands, but I'm very fascinated with Sam Cooke's involvement or expression of the civil rights movement in his songs, especially Change Is Gonna Come, which is one of my all-time favorites. And I recall you said he it was partly based on his arrest for refusing to leave a segregated hotel in Shreveport.
Right.
And then you alluded to Celeste, how he engaged in, quote, some reckless behavior in the face of a Memphis, Tennessee police officer.
Well, yeah, and there are other instances.
Yeah, and other instances, you say, reflected perhaps his teachings by his father, don't let anyone disrespect you or something
right,
like that.
Right, right.
I'm curious, what were the circumstances surrounding his death, and did it have anything to do with this reckless attitude?
I think so, yeah. I mean, I think that he was at a motel with a woman. She ran off with his clothes and his money. He thought she went into the motel manager's apartment, and when the motel manager wouldn't let him in, he broke down the door. Mm. And in the ensuing struggle, he was shot. But in terms of his, aside from the specific circumstances, of the situation, in which virtually any rhythm and any entertainer might have found himself. I mean, I don't think there's a single person in this book, which is of quite a wide ranging cast of characters, who didn't live the same life. So, but leaving aside what precipitated Sam's death specifically, I think, was he simply was not going to be, just as in Shreveport. In Shreveport, he was just screaming at the motel manager. Mm-hmm. His brother Charles, who prides himself on being an original gangster, you know, is telling Sam, "We got to get out of here, man. You know, these people are crazy." His road manager for the Soulstores, S.R. Crane, is saying, Sammy, we've got to leave." Barbara's saying, "Sam." Barbara, Sam's wife, is saying, "Sam, we've got to get out of here. These people are going to kill you." And he's saying, "They're not going to kill me. I'm Sam Cook." And Barbara says to him, "They'd just as soon kill you as look at you." Now, he didn't get killed in that situation, but that's he would not back off. And I think what happened, with his death was it was a situation in which he saw himself as being played. He was not going to be backed off. He was not going to back off. He was not going to accept any explanation. He was going to get his clothes. He was going to get his money back, and he was going to get some kind of satisfaction, and he got shot.
What year was this?
This was December 11th, 1964.
All right. Thank you, sir.
Sure.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. We're here already at the end of the time.
That's terrible. I feel like we're just getting started.
I know. We're just warming up. To wrap up, maybe we could go to your author's note in Dream Boogie, where you speak of Du Bois and James Baldwin.
Right.
The term Tunis and Baldwin's writing of a community in which imagination and self-examination trump pedigree. You want to wrap up here for us, expand on that a little bit?
Well, you know, I mean, it's just the point that Baldwin makes, just it's the same point that Ralph Ellison or Albert Murray or Zora Neale Hurston makes, is that through this sense of exclusion, through the fact that you have people who are thrown together in virtually, you know, everything they do and where they're allowed to live and where they're allowed to eat and where they're, you created a society of such extraordinary vitality, of such extraordinary creativity, of such extraordinary self-nourishment. I mean, Baldwin, I quote Baldwin from The Fire Next Time as saying, there's a sense of being present in everything from the effort of making love, from the effort of love to breaking bread. And there's this sense in which everyone is thrown together in a common cause, you know, hustler, thief, doctor, lawyer, pharmacist, hooker, you know, it doesn't matter. Everyone is thrown together into the same pot, and that out of that comes just a culture and a society which offers a model and the underpinning for almost all of the mainstream culture which we see about around us today, whether it's acknowledged or it's not acknowledged. And I think this is the world that Sam Cooke came out of, and it's a world that he recognized. Sam Cooke read John Hope Franklin's From Slavery to Freedom in around 1960, and it set him off He was a voracious reader, but this particular book, John Hope Franklin's, set him off on a systematic reading of black literature and black history, and he acquired a library of black history, not just African American, but going back to Africa and Egypt, and it gave him, I think, a perspective, and it gave him it reinforced the same sense of pride that he had felt growing up in Bronzeville on the south side of Chicago in an entirely segregated world, which I wish I could, you know, quote Baldwin's description from memory, but which, while it was forced to deal with the cruelty of prejudice, with systematic exclusion in every sense, created its own culture, its own language, and its own vitality, something that simply was irreplaceable and something which Sam Cooke seized on and sought to express in all of his work.
We have to leave it there. Let's wrap up with "That's Where It's At." And Peter, thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thank you. I've really enjoyed it.
Peter Gorelnick, his latest book is Dream Boogie, The Triumph of Sam Cooke.